Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. President Bush leads his State of the Union address with new initiatives on health care and energy policy, and he pushes ahead increasing troops in Iraq despite congressional efforts to rebuke that policy. Presidential hopefuls continue to line up for 2008, and some are dropping out. And the vice president's former chief of staff blames his legal troubles on Karl Rove. Joining me in the studio for the first hour of our Friday morning news roundup, Washington Post columnist Jean Robinson, Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor, Todd Lindberg of Policy Review. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Good to be here.
And as always, please join us at 1-800-433-8850 or email us at drshow@wamu.org. We'll take your calls and your emails as part of our conversation here this morning. I want to ask each of you, tell me what's the most significant thing about this speech, Gene?
I think the most significant thing is what the president said about Iraq. I mean, he has doubled down, and we knew that. But he gave a full explanation, I think, of why he's he wants to send, or he is sending, more troops to Iraq to secure Baghdad, and he gave that explanation in front of a Congress that disagrees with him, and a nation that disagrees with him, and I think setting up that kind of face off was the most significant thing in the speech.
Linda, your take.
Well, aside from Iraq, I mean, they had promised a domestic policy-heavy speech and then gave us half on Iraq. But who can argue that Iraq isn't the 800-pound gorilla in the policy mix? I was also struck by the modesty of his domestic proposals. Bush has preferred to be bold in his initiatives, and now he's almost becoming Clinton-esque and sort of scaling back what he thinks is doable. And he put forth things that he thought there might be common ground with the Democrats, but that's completely not clear.
Todd Lindberg.
Well, I think to start with the rather gracious way in which he recognized the new Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. I thought that was it was more than he had to do. He had to do something, but he did more than that. And the second thing I would say, oddly enough, is that this was a speech that I think conservatives were ready not to like from all they'd heard about it in advance. And actually, upon delivery, there's a very different impression that pretty rapidly formed about it. I think in talking about his domestic policy initiatives, he actually staked out some policy territory that is fairly conservative, and particularly on the health care reform proposal. And whether that has any real chance of coming through Congress in anything like the form in which he proposed it is nevertheless a kind of way of getting the discussion going, in which he did not begin by negotiating with himself.
Now, I'll tell you, in listening to it, I thought the two most important words he said that night were "Madam Speaker."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Particularly with Hillary Clinton sitting in the audience, where we're about to have a national debate about can a woman be president, I thought that certainly was also very much a part of it. I thought he was very gracious, Todd, but just the mere fact that there was a woman standing behind for the first time in the history of our country
was certainly an historic occasion, and I think you marked it pretty well.
Let me ask you, Gene, you started talking about Iraq, you say he set up a confrontation with an increasingly restive Congress. But his tone was a little different. A lot of people said it was almost pleading, give me a chance. This is not the march to victory, mission accomplished president we've seen before.
It was a very subdued tone. I mean, you know, you had it was an interesting evening because you had these two bookend moments. The one we just talked about, where he recognized Nancy Pelosi in that very, very gracious way. I mean, that was a real high point, and that'll be in the history books, I think. And at the end, he introduced the subway hero, Wesley Autry, to the biggest cheer of the night. In between, it was very subdued. You know, chastened is not a word that I associate with George W. Bush, and I don't think he would feel chastened. But there was almost a plaintive air about it, and he was saying, "Give it time. Give us a chance." Again, to a Congress that doesn't want to do that, that thinks he's had enough time and that he's had enough chances.
And Linda, a rather stark contrast to Senator Jim Webb, mm-hmm. the freshman from Virginia, who gave an unusually confrontational speech as the Democratic respondent.
Right. I mean, Jim Webb, not only being a decorated Vietnam War hero, former Secretary of the Navy as a Republican, he's a published author and a very good one at that. He knows how to use words. And that was a smart choice on the part of the Democrats to put him up as the Democratic response. You knew you were going to get, unvarnished Jim Webb in that 9 minutes.
Were you surprised when he used the word reckless in describing the way the president conducted the war?
No, I wasn't. We knew what he thought from what he said during the campaign, and he hasn't let up.
You know, and one of the interesting themes of the president's speech was an attempt to cast a lot of what's going on. Are you in favor of the troops or not? He mentioned that a number of times in his speech. And the Democrats selecting Jim Webb, whose son is serving in Iraq, who campaigned with his son's combat boots, this was part of the Democratic effort, wasn't it, to counteract the notion that if you're against the war, you're against the troops?
Well, this is part of the broader effort on the part of the Democrats to create an image of muscular Democrat. You have a decent number of military people who were elected to Congress this time as Democrats, and this is part of the greater effort to convince voters to turn the presidency over to the Democratic Party in 2 years. And Jim Webb is one of the lead characters in that fight.
But Todd, Jim Webb also said that he was in favor of policy of removing troops in short order, and a lot of supporters of the president said, tell me the difference between short order and precipitous withdrawal.
Well, I think that's actually a pretty interesting question. You can tell where the difference of tone and emphasis lies, but as for an actual policy alternative, I'm not so sure. And it may be that Democrats really don't need to do that, that a position that is simply critical is adequate. I know we're going to talk about the pending resolutions and all that shortly, but I wonder really if the party is entirely in control of its own position on this stuff, or if it doesn't start to get driven a little bit I think you've got a congressional Democratic majority that considers itself to be a majority because of its position on the war on Iraq in these elections, and that has consequences.
But it's also true that the resolution that did pass Senate Foreign Relations by 12-9 with only one Republican vote, Senator Hagel of Nebraska, is a non-binding resolution. It says it opposes the troop buildup, saying it's not in the national interest, but there is no talk, as you hear from the Democratic left, no talk of using the power of the purse to cut off funds. This is not a particularly confrontational resolution.
Yeah, and of course I agree with that. But if it can be confined to that level of opposition, then that's fine. But what I'm wondering about is this: once this resolution presumably passes, we'll have action on the ground in Iraq, et cetera. And I wonder if the same sort of pressure that led to the passage of this resolution in the first place isn't also going to lead to the question, well, and now that you've passed the resolution, what are you going to do about it? And that's the point at which things get really interesting.
Before we get to that, Gene, talk about this resolution. As I said, it passed 12-9. But there is also a competing resolution sponsored very significantly by Senator John Warner, Republican of Virginia, one of the deans of the Senate and a very authoritative voice on military policy, which would mirror the Democratic resolution by opposing the buildup, but is much softer in tone and sort of pays more homage to the president.
Exactly. It uses,
what's going to come out of here?
It uses the Democratic resolution uses the word escalation, which Senator Warner doesn't like. I think he's adopted Secretary Rice's term of augmentation, which and I'm still trying to parse the difference there. But you know, I think what's going to be really, these are resolutions that aren't that far apart, really. I mean, they disapprove of the escalation / augmentation.
Do you think they'll come
troops.
To it? Do you have a sense that eventually there will be one resolution? Democrats seem to want that.
I think they do. I mean, Senator Biden says he's willing to look at changes in his language to accommodate Senator Warner. He seems to want more than one Republican on board. He wants more than Senator Hagel on board, and it would really send a more powerful message, I think, if there's substantial Republican support for an anti-escalation resolution.
There does seem to be 6, 7, 8 potential mm-hmm. Republican votes in the full Senate, or maybe even more, depending on how the resolution.
Depending on what the resolution says, there could be more, but I think there's certainly at least 5, 6, 7 votes.
Interesting note this week on this final point on Iraq here, Linda, that while the president took perhaps a subdued tone, the vice president, mm-hmm. no one has ever accused Dick Cheney of taking a subdued tone on these issues, and he gave a much more mm-hmm. truculent mm-hmm. View, saying the resolution will not stop us. He talked about the enormous successes. The president seemed to be struggling to try to show that he was in touch with reality in his speech. But the vice president, not acknowledging the critics, in fact, taking on the critics, mm-hmm. Repeating a familiar administration line that the press is misrepresenting the situation in Iraq by focusing too much on the devastation. What role was Cheney playing this week as opposed to the president?
Well, he's always been viewed as sort of the emissary to the base. I mean, he's the red meat to the party, the people, the shrinking core of the Republican base that is sticking with the president on this no matter what. It is sort of startling to hear the president acting as if he does know he's in big trouble, and then you've got Cheney just coming out with the most harsh rhetoric and just firm, you know, straightforward, the media is making this up kind of line.
Well, the thing, though, Steve and Linda, is that at this point in his popularity ratings, the only ones he has to lose are essentially right. Republicans.
Sure.
The independents have pretty much gone. Democrats long gone. And so I think you need a two-track thing. You need to talk to the base as well, because you want to keep them, you want to at least keep them.
Our Friday News Roundup will be right back. We'll talk about some of the domestic initiatives. The president talked about health care, energy, and other issues. So give us a call. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts. I'm sitting in today for Diane Rehm. And it's, of course, as always, our Friday morning news roundup. And with me, Gene Robinson, is columnist for The Washington Post, Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor, and Todd Lindbergh of Policy Review. You can join us at 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. One of you mentioned earlier, Linda, that Iraq overshadows everything. Glenn Bolger, a prominent and well-regarded Republican pollster said, you know, this is Iraq just casts a huge shadow over everything the president does. It sucks the energy out of the air, and it certainly has diminished some of his political clout. Mm-hmm. And he was facing a Democratic Congress for the first time in his presidency. But he did spend, as you point out, half of his speech on significant domestic initiatives, and certainly health care was one of them. He was out yesterday in Missouri promoting this. It's a plan basically that would tax people who have a more expensive health care plans, so the so-called gold-plated plans, taxing those benefits for the first time, because under the current tax code, those benefits from employers are not treated as income. For the first time, they would be taxable, and the idea is to take some of this money and put it into tax deductions that people who don't now have health insurance, 47 million Americans uninsured, could then afford it. What's been the reaction to this basic plan from the president?
Well, the Democrats are pretty universally negative, declaring it dead on arrival. Republicans are positive, but then there is some concern that you can call a part of that a tax increase, because you would tax a family plan that's worth above $15,000. But, you know, the point is that this effort to ensure more Americans on health is just crucial and central to the future of this country. It's going to be a major issue in the presidential campaign. We've got 47 million uninsured Americans. So I think at base, it puts the issue on the table, and it's now, I think, up to the Democrats to come up with an alternative and see if they can come together and at least accomplish something. Because in November of 2008, if nothing has been accomplished in the next 2 years, then I think the Democrats could face some trouble. I mean, they...
One of the reasons why the Democrats seem to be so opposed to it is that many of the people who have these most expensive plans are union members,
right,
who have negotiated these as part of their contracts. Now, only about 12% of American workers are now unionized. But is this partly a political calculation that they do not want to displease their union?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the unions don't have the clout that they used to politically, but they do still have a lot of clout. And anything that touches union benefits, you're going to get an important Democratic constituency rising up.
Todd, the president yesterday in Missouri said it was pure politics for the Democrats to simply dump on this plan without taking it seriously. Are you surprised that Democrats are not more willing to take this seriously?
Well, I think
the president right in calling it a political reaction?
Yeah, it's a political reaction, but you know, there's a time-honored tradition of proposals floated by the president in the State of the Union being pronounced dead on arrival by Congress when it is in control of the other party. It doesn't necessarily mean that nothing ever gets done along those lines, but you know, there's no particular political incentive for Democrats to get up and say, "Great idea, let's go." You know, they need to. I mean, they've got this issue in their Q2. They've got some ideas on the subject. Now, the question, to me, the real question, I think Linda was kind of getting at it, is, you know, is this something anybody really wants to do something about in this Congress, or is this something that is essentially a bid for positioning with regard to the 2008 campaign? Now, I think, you know, if I were thinking about where I would want to be as a Democrat running for a president in 2008, I think I might want this issue. I think I might want something other than a large bill that takes this off the table.
But
And Republican position is also somewhat interesting in that regard. You know, Bush, in putting this forward, deprives Democrats of the argument, essentially, that the White House isn't interested in this.
But, Gene, Democrats are now in control. We were saying earlier, the president, first time in his 6 years facing a Democratic Congress, first time in 12 years, the Democrats are running the place, running these committees. Don't they have an incentive beyond pure political calculation to prove to the voters a year or two from now, hey, we actually got something done on an issue you care about, and health care is high on everybody's list?
You know, they do have an incentive, but health care is hard. It's really hard. It's really complicated. You know, I don't know if they can get it done. Even in a couple of years, I don't know if they can get it done. If they did, I think it'd be good for the country. I agree with Todd that this is a good issue. You know, the candidates are already staking out their positions on it. Obama came out for some sort of universal health coverage the other day, and of course Hillary Clinton has been involved in the issue, these many years. I think they may see this as kind of the centerpiece of their campaigns. So I don't know if they're going to be pressing for a full resolution of this issue, or even think they can get it.
Of course, one of the bottom lines here is if they do come to any sort of an agreement, they're going to have to troop down to the Rose Garden and share the credit
exactly.
with the Republican president.
Exactly.
Linda, another major domestic initiative in this speech, one that the president talked about last year when he talked about addiction to oil, revived his emphasis. But he said a couple of new things. First of all, he even said the phrase climate change, mm-hmm. which was significant. But also he agreed with a lot of critics who said that one of the key issues here is that the Congress has lagged behind in increasing fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. Mm-hmm. Significance of his speech on energy.
Well, that is significant, especially in light of, you know, we've had a warm winter in spite of the very cold weather today we're having in Washington. You've got Ford Motor Company with, you know, terrible losses. The American auto industry is in trouble. And you've got, you know, global warming overshadowing all of this. And, you know, there's so many interests at play here. You've got his push for ethanol, which, of course, gets back to politics and the interests of you know, the Farm Belt and, you know, the need for just better auto efficiency. It's one of those things where everybody knows this is extremely important. Nancy Pelosi announced a select committee on global warming in advance of State of the Union, I think, to kind of get out in front on that issue. But at the end of the day, it's something that we're all feeling and agree that something does need to be done.
Well, given the president's attitude and given the longstanding interest of Democrats to move on this, what about the possibility of progress here?
That's a tough one. I just don't have a feel for that. I think I don't know that anybody really does at this point.
Let's turn to politics, although we've been talking about politics all along. The other major domestic event, hardly a surprise, but yet extremely significant, Todd, Hillary Rodham Clinton announcing for president, but she chose to do it in a very interesting way, using very interesting language. This was not your balloons and confetti and on a stage announcement. It was done by video, sitting in a living room, sitting on a couch with a flowered pillow behind her. What do you make of this?
Well, the first thing you have to say is, what about the timing of it, too? You know, is this something, as her people have indicated, that had long been planned, or is this actually a response to the Barack Obama entry into the field and the way in which he's generated as much enthusiasm as he has? Second, I think... you know, I think we need to be ready for a Hillary Clinton campaign that actually has a bit of a bubble quality to it. I don't think she's going to be out in uncontrolled environments, in kind of back-of-the-bus kind of scenarios with the traveling press corps, et cetera. In a way, there was a certain intimacy to this, but also, I think, a certain distance, just because it was... just because it was so highly electronic, an event as opposed to with real people involved in it.
You know, we always gauge events as political reporters partly about what is not seen and not heard. And one of the things that struck me is by doing it this way, she was able to leave out one very important person in the announcement, and that's Bill Clinton, because if she had had some sort of public event, she would have had to have had,
he would have
Bill
had
Clinton
to be there.
Be there. And it seemed to me this was one of the interesting dimensions.
That may have been the solution to a very delicate problem.
Now, in addition to that, Gene, the language she used, in addition to the setting, the soft lighting, the flowered pillow, it's hard to imagine a man announcing for president sitting in that setting. Mm-hmm. It's also hard to imagine a man using that language. She said, let's chat. Mm-hmm. Let's have a conversation. Men talk about campaigns as battles and crusades and missions. And mm-hmm. she said, let's chat. It seemed to me that part of what she was doing was trying to turn what has previously been considered in some ways a drawback, her gender, into an asset. She's running very much as a woman. It's a significant shift.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a softening of the edges. I think the campaign believes and is correct that she is perceived by some people as kind of brittle and unapproachable. And I think she wanted to, let's chat. I mean, to have that sort of soft kind of image. But there's another really interesting thing that she chose the medium of the internet. You know, there's an interesting kind of a campaign going on the web now. I mean, if you look at Obama's website, he has his own announcement video that's not quite as well produced as hers is, but he wants a dialogue instead of a conversation. And then if you look at John Edwards, what he's been doing there, he has this very elaborate kind of social networking website in which he's doing a kind of web diary. Elizabeth is doing a web diary that's very personal. So they're using this medium, which is so impersonal on one level, to reach people, which this medium can do in a different way.
In addition, though, to the softening of the Hillary, warmth, not coldness, which this video was very much designed to do, it also struck me that there was a very hard political calculation behind it, Linda. If you look at the ABC Washington Post poll this week, her favorable rating is actually 11% higher among women voters than among men. She is the favorite of 48% of Democratic voters, whereas female voters, but only 30% of male voters. We know that women vote in larger numbers than men. They could be as much as 54% of the electorate next year. It seemed to me that part of what was at work here was a very careful appeal to women voters and to play to a political strength and to try to, not entirely, but to some extent, pitch her campaign to female voters.
Absolutely. And you've got the women's movement, such as it is, has already rallied to her side. You've got Emily's List, which is the largest PAC in the country, has already endorsed her, and they command a fair amount of attention among activist women in this country. And I think you'll see among younger women some excitement at the potential for the first woman president. On this issue of how she rolled out her campaign, I think a big question will be around her authenticity. She has teams and teams of advisors, and she's got tons of money, and everything is scripted to within an inch of its life. And by the way, when she did these web chats earlier this week, they were pre-screened questions. So I think she has to be careful that she's not too packaged and too kind of even calculating in the way she conducts her campaign.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. There are other people who got in the race and got out of the race this week. Todd, quickly, perhaps the most significant announcement from John Kerry came awfully close. Certainly has not lost the taste for presidential politics. You always have to remember the old Mo Udall line, the only cure for presidential ambitions is embalming fluid. And yet, he did pull out. Why?
Well, I think the only person who was really who really thought that he belonged seriously in this race may have been Senator Kerry himself. I didn't detect much in the way of support for repeat last year, of last time around. And at some point, it just becomes clear that it's not going to happen. And there's just been there's too much other action and interest on the Democratic side. You've got three very interesting candidates in Senator Clinton and Senator Obama and former Senator Edwards. And, nobody really thinks that the reason John Kerry lost last time around is because somehow he got a raw deal.
And also talk briefly about Sam Brownback, not a well-known national figure, but threw his hat in the race in the Republican side.
Senator
from Kansas.
I think that this might be another of those interesting phenomena of someone running for vice president. It's possible that at some point the person on the head of the GOP ticket, if it's a McCain or Giuliani, if he's in fact running or something, will want someone who's got serious conservative credentials in order to unify the party coming out of the convention and have a good run at the general election. And it's never rarely is it foolish to kind of get in, even if you don't really have any much chance of or expectation of winning, if you're really serious about your ambitions.
Well, one of the things about Brownback, he is described often as the favorite of evangelical Christians in the Republican Party, but he's also been against the war. He's developing an interesting political profile.
It's a very interesting political profile. We'll see how well it travels.
Gene, I want to ask you about someone else who deserves mention here, and that's Bill Richardson. Hispanic, Mexican mother, governor of New Mexico. The question is raised, is America ready for a non-white male president? We've had 43 presidents, every one white male. I looked up the figures. In the vote last fall, only 39% of the American electorate were white men. And here you have a Hispanic who, not a top-tier candidate, mm-hmm. but this is part of a larger change, isn't it, that you have the three leading candidates are not white men in the Democratic mm-hmm. Party today.
I think it's fascinating. It says something. It's hard to define readiness, you know, is America ready? I mean, what's different this time from 4 years ago? It is fascinating. I tend to think, and, you know, based on not much evidence, but that America may be readier for a woman president than a non-white male president.
Why do you think that?
We don't have national election history to go by, but if you look at statewide elections, a lot more women governors and senators have been elected than non-white male governors and senators. I mean, there have been two black governors in the history of the Republic, and there are, what, eight or nine sitting female governors now. And in the Senate, the 16, I think, mm-hmm. Women senators and one black senator, and that's usually the quota. So so if you can extrapolate from that, you would say it'll be a woman first.
But quick question to you. Significance of the fact that the two coaches in the Super Bowl are both African-Americans.
That's, you know, significant. I mean, it's been a long time coming. 70% of the players in the National Football League are black. Still a minority of coaches are black. Amazing.
We'll be right back. Hold that thought, Gene Robinson.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. Additional support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, committed to creating opportunities for people to live freer, better, and more prosperous lives, online at fordfound.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup, a deadly week in Iraq for civilians and U.S. troops. The violence and the political tensions in Lebanon take a turn for the worse, and China conducts a successful anti-satellite missile test. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. It's our Friday News Roundup, and I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and Gene Robinson of the Washington Post with me, Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor, Todd Lindbergh of the Policy Review, and we'll go to a couple of your emails first. And Howard from Washington, D.C., asks, the one word Bush did not say in his speech was Katrina. Why didn't he talk about rebuilding New Orleans? You've written about this, Gene.
Yeah, I wrote about that in this morning's paper. It's amazing. Not one word about Hurricane Katrina, not one word about the city of New Orleans, which remains in desperate straits, less than half of its original or its prior population. As you know, Steve, whole neighborhoods still in ruins, left to mold and decay. I thought it was just a shocking omission, and people in New Orleans are not pleased that he seems to have forgotten his promises to rebuild the great city.
Todd also omitted from the speech was any reference to the Republican Trinity of recent years of God's gays and guns. So all of the traditional appeals to social issues, not one word about abortion, not one word about same-sex marriage, not one word about stem cell research. What was that about?
Well, you can overread. One thing the speech was a laundry list. And, mm-hmm. He focused on a relatively small number of areas and developed them in a little greater detail than presidents usually do in States of the Union. So maybe that's the reason why some of these omissions are there. On the other hand, maybe there is a realization that an overemphasis on those kinds of issues was having an effect in terms of diminishing the appeal of the Republican Party. You could look back and say that the previous Congress, with the final Republican majority, was really almost entirely an exercise in conservative identity politics, social conservative issues being brought to the fore, whether it's the abortion-related set or, in a way, the way the House in particular queued up the immigration issue. Frankly, that's attractive in one part of the country, but demonstrably not so in other areas.
And therefore, higher risk if you're giving a national speech as to one, say, at the conservative convention. Well,
and in addition, I think there is not a Republican majority that would be in a position to demand those kinds of references.
One of the results of the shift in power.
That's right.
The agenda will be very different in Congress. Let me read a note here from Michael in Michigan, Linda. Could you please ask your guests why cutting off funding for additional troop deployment in Iraq seems so incomprehensible for Congress? Isn't it clear that refusing to increase military activity is not the same as cutting the troops' current funding?
Well, the problem is that if funds are cut, if there's any kind of freezing of funding or reduction of funding, the Democrats could pay a huge political price for that, and they know that. They are still struggling with the legacy of the Vietnam War, and the party's image for a generation as being weak on defense, and especially when your leading contender for the presidency is a woman, they especially don't want to come close to that accusation.
But Gene, Todd raised an interesting point earlier that there can be a fairly large consensus, certainly among Democrats, even with significant Republican backing, a non-binding resolution down the road when people in the on the left wing of the Democratic Party are going to start raising their voices.
Absolutely.
On cutting off funding. This can present a much more difficult problem, mm-hmm. as Linda says, for the Democrats.
It is. It's going to be a really difficult management job for Nancy Pelosi, especially. I think she's made clear that that's a step she doesn't want to really take now, and doesn't much want to talk about. But sure, pressure is going to build down the road. The president has enormous latitude. He can send the extra troops. He can send more, yet more, if he wants to. And as time goes on, you're right, it's going to become a big issue.
Particularly, of course, depending on what happens in the field.
Exactly. Exactly.
General Petraeus testified this week on Capitol Hill, and he said, we'll know by the end of the summer whether there is a significant impact of the new policy. So mm-hmm. probably people hold their fire for now, but that's not that far along.
It's not that far along. And, we're, as I read the coverage from Iraq, there was a particular particularly good story in the Times yesterday. There have been really good stories in the Post as well about the on-the-ground challenges that this new deployment will face in working with Iraqi forces that are in no way ready to or inclined to do what needs to be done in even telling who's shooting at them and why. I think we're gonna get there pretty soon.
Let's turn to some of our callers who've been waiting patiently, and let's start with Tony in Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Tony.
Hey, big problem I see is we've been trying to fight this war and be PC at the same time, and war is not PC, and it seems that's the way the Democrats want it.
What do you mean by that, Tony?
Well, it's like they don't realize who we're fighting. I mean, you know, where's their prisons? You know, the way they treat us. And look at some of the things they do. Like the other day, they took a dead body, you know, gutted it and put explosives in it, and then waited for somebody to come get the body and then blowed it up. I mean, we're not fighting people. We're fighting animals. And I think they need to be treated as such.
Okay, Tony, thank you. Linda?
That is a common argument among some Americans. I think the answer to that is that we as Americans want to behave better than that. We don't want to stoop to their level. And I guess I'll leave it at that.
Let's turn to Tom in Raleigh, North Carolina. Tom, welcome to Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, how are you?
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to make a couple points. And I think the deployment that Bush is trying to bring about is really happening because the Iraqi people are turning to Seder and other nationalists that really want the U.S. out. Now, the neocons fear losing Baghdad, especially at a time when they're trying to find a way to attack Iran. But I think the message from Iraq, from the people of Iraq, and from our own people, if we care to listen to them, it supposedly is a democracy, it's time to get out. www.bringthemhomenow. Thanks.
Okay, Tom. Todd.
Right. Again, and I think this is the kind of pressure that's going to be mounting on Democrats. This kind of we thought we sent a message in the 2006 election. Why aren't we getting delivery on what we said, you know, I guess you'll be doing a lot more on the situation in Iraq in the next hour of the Diane Rehm Show. So maybe we don't want to comment on that too extensively. But it's clear that at the moment the Iraqi voting patterns have been by ethnic group, and that's an issue. There was no sort of nationalist party that emerged. But I think on the other hand, it's also not necessarily surprising that's the case, given the history there. I don't say that that there is a necessarily positive outcome that's going to come from this, but there is at least the hope that Sadr is not representative of the majority view of Shiites.
Linda, our first two callers obviously represented and reflected some very strongly held disagreements in America today, as they are on Capitol Hill. One of the things that is happening this weekend is a march on Washington. This war and this anti-war movement, as much as it showed itself in the polls, has not showed itself in the streets very much. And given the, you know, our last caller, do you expect to see a greater public reflection of this anti-war sentiment our last caller displayed?
I don't see a dramatic escalation in that. I think this weekend they're expecting crowds in the tens of thousands, not in the hundreds of thousands. These are different times. This isn't the 60s. We're not having this whole countercultural revolution going on while we're having a war. In a way that's less significant than it might seem. I mean, everybody knows this war is incredibly unpopular. They can read the polls. The president, I think, gets it. This was reflected in the election. And even the organizers of these marches know that they're not going to get millions of people in the streets, so they are marching the halls of Congress and working the angles that way.
Let's turn to Ava in Old Mystic, Connecticut.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for calling us.
Thank you. I'd like to comment on the president's health plan.
Sure.
Rejecting it outright isn't partisan in my mind. It's another example of this administration's corporate solutions that don't help people. What good are tax credits if you can't afford the premiums? taxing the benefits is just, to me, a backdoor tax increase. And then because of a remark you made, I've always said America would elect a woman when the men made a big enough mess for them.
Well, how long? It might be a good year for you then. Gene, apropos of Eva's comment, your own newspaper editorialized saying one of the ways that the health plan might be improved is to change tax deductions, which don't help the poorest of the poor because they don't pay taxes, into a tax credit.
Exactly.
Is one of the issues that, as Eva points out?
Yeah, I mean, that would be one way to make it, I think, a more workable solution. I agree with the editorial board on that point. But, you know, as I said before, this is a really hard issue. Once you start giving people tax credits, I guess you don't have to give it to upper income people. You don't want to run the risk that healthy people will decide to get out of corporate, of the company paid plans because they can get it cheaper, and then only the sick people remain in the company paid plans, and those collapse, and then you have a whole bunch of other people you have to insure. It's very complicated.
I think that credit idea is one that Bush would accept in a heartbeat if he could get the other broad outline of the proposal through.
But what about this argument that our caller made that this is a backdoor tax increase? Now, that is, you said earlier that you thought the speech was more conservative or more more reflecting of conservative values than perhaps you expected. Republicans going to accept something that could be labeled a tax increase?
This would be a fundamental reform, a fundamentally different way of conceiving how we go about paying for health insurance in this country, because it would decenter it from employers. Employers would still be able to pay it, but it would be like your salary. It would be taxable, except that there would be this credit at the national level. And what the credit does at the national level is that it levels the playing field for people who are not in a position to get insurance from their employers. They can have the same kind of tax benefit, which they do not currently have when they go out and buy their policy. So that's the big difference.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Time for a couple of more callers. Let's go to David in Little Rock, Arkansas. Welcome to The Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Hey, I'm tired of the president once again setting the language for what's being discussed over there. You know, he's talking about defunding the war as something that would be like turning off a pipe right now, and you get this image of soldiers being in the theater without ammunition or supplies right now. I think there should be benchmarks put on this administration, as he's talked about doing with al-Maliki, and saying, well, you know, General Petraeus says we should see some change by summer. Well, that's fine. We will fund you at our current rate through summer. Then if you and Dick Cheney can walk the length of Haifa Street in Baghdad and get to the other end and not need to change your pants, we will continue to fund the war. Otherwise, you know, we'll fund you for a certain amount of time, and then all we're going to fund is redeployment of the troops out of theater, and we're going to shut this down because you're not getting anywhere.
Thank you, David. One of the things we haven't talked about, Linda, is the House of Representatives and its attitude toward this war. And one of the things you're seeing among House Republicans is talk about a resolution that will set benchmarks, a word that a year ago the administration found deeply offensive, but is now much more common on Capitol Hill, even among Republicans.
That's right. I mean, you have John Boehner, the House Republican leader, putting forth a resolution that would do just that. So what we're seeing on Capitol Hill is basically every member wants to be able to sign on to something. Everybody needs to be seen coming back at the administration with some kind of, not toughness necessarily, but just, hey, we're involved. We think this needs to be done. There needs to be some sense of forward motion from everybody.
Let's talk to Andrew in Syracuse, New York. Welcome, Andrew, to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, good morning.
Hey.
We're hearing a question of whether a woman can be elected to the office of president. And I'm thinking, isn't the real question whether a woman will be allowed to be elected in a society that's still dominated primarily by a white male Protestant culture?
Okay. Who's got an answer?
I guess you could phrase it that way, but it kind of comes down to the to the same question, and I tend to think a woman can be elected in this country, but we'll see. I think.
Is it significant to you, Gene, that the Socialist Party in France just nominated a woman to be a candidate for president? The Chancellor of Germany is a woman. Beyond the role models, as you mentioned earlier, 16 women in the Senate. There are models around the world that America lags way behind.
There are and have been for Margaret Thatcher, Indira Gandhi. I mean, there are plenty of models of very strong female leaders in the world, and America has been very far behind.
Why do you think that's true, Linda? I mean, I looked this up the other day. The first female elected head of state in the world was in Iceland in 1980. That was 27 years ago. Why does America lag so far?
I think it's because we don't have a parliamentary system. I mean, I think I can't imagine that Margaret Thatcher would have been elected in a direct vote the way we elect presidents. I really think that's what it comes down to.
And Todd, one of the other dimensions of the Hillary Clinton candidacy is so interesting. Every asset is a potential drawback in any candidate. And in her appeals to be softer and start a conversation and say let's chat and appeal to the women's vote, whoever's the next president is going to take office at a time of war. Whatever else happens in Iraq, we know there's going to be a war. Does this also become a problem for her in terms of that old cliche about women being capable commanders of a military?
Well, obviously, people are going to raise that question. You're never going to sell Republicans on the proposition that she'll be a good commander in chief. But then again, the hardcore Republican base wasn't going to vote for a Democrat anyway. So what we're talking about is the middle that remains up for grabs. I think she's done some things that have gained her some, credibility on defense, military, other kinds of issues. They've actually hurt her a little bit on the left side of her own party.
Very quickly, Linda, the Lewis Libby trial started this week. Very important trial, a very complicated trial, but he's being charged with lying, not with leaking. But his defense was that he was being made a scapegoat by the White House, who was trying to protect Karl Rove, the president's political advisor, on the eve of the 2004 election. Quickly, what have we learned so far in the Libby trial?
Well, we've learned a lot. I mean, the curtain is being peeled back on the inner workings of the vice president's office, which is just very juicy and fascinating. You're seeing, the power struggles and internally, and you're seeing, how they deal with the press. The Kathy Martin yesterday going through the different options of how to get their point across. Do we leak, which is ironic? Do we have a press conference? I mean, this is just great stuff for students of government.
And of course, Tim Russert might be appalled to see that they said, let's put him on Meet the Press so we can control the message. It's been a great hour. Thanks so much. Linda Feldman from the Christian Science Monitor, Todd Lindbergh from Policy Review,
thanks,
Gene Robinson from the Washington
Thanks,
Post.
Thanks, Steve.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. Engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassettes, CD sales, transcripts, and lots of other stuff. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.